everyone. Thank you for coming this morning. Before we get into the Dharma talk, and for those of you who maybe are new, you'll hear mostly we do speak in English here, but every now and then you'll hear a few words like Dharma or Sangha that are kind of just, they're actually Sanskrit words, and they're kind of fundamental words in Buddhism. Dharma has various meanings, but we talk about Dharma as kind of the word that refers to the teachings, all the teachings and the practices that are practiced, taught and practiced in Buddhism. That is the Dharma, the way of awakening. It's the Dharma. A Sangha means the community of people who practice the Dharma. That's Sangha. So I think those are the only words you might have heard so far today. If you're new, you may not be familiar with. But speaking of that, before I begin, are there any questions that anybody has about the practices that we did this morning, or else anything else that you've heard or observed since you've been here today? Anything not clear or questions about? I mean, if you do, this is not the time not to ask. This is the time. Because the important thing is, the important thing is to practice. And to know how to practice, what to do with your mind, how to deal with distractions, thoughts. So, if anything's not clear, please. So then I can assume that everything is clear? Just nod your head if that's the case. Good. Well, don't come to me later, you had your opportunity. Actually, before I begin, let me just give a little background. I think many of you know that in the past 3 or 4 weeks in our community, we have begun 3 different intensives. These are very much part of the practice side of our community. Members practice, and many of them in these intensives, which are usually they're 3 months, 6 months, part A, part B, and they deal with various, and I'll explain a little bit, various aspects of Buddhist practice and teaching, but allows people like ourselves, lay people who work and have families and have responsibilities, etc., to be able to go more deeply into the practice and get more support in the practice as they carry on their daily life activities. So currently, we have 3 intensives that began in the last 3 or 4 weeks. I think altogether about 130 people are involved in these intensives. And they really cover really the kind of fundamentals of the way we practice in this community. The first intensive, and again, usually most people are just in one of the intensives. So it's sort of, it's not as if you're in all of them. And they have a kind of a sequential unfolding. One intensive is an intensive that's really helping people to learn and support them and learning how to be mindful. Sort of the practice we did this morning, how to learn to be mindful of the body, of the breath, how to be present. In our culture, we have a culture that promotes distraction. You might have noticed that, endlessly trying to distract us and stimulate us. So people often have very out of control minds. Minds that never stop, that often causes them stress and other kinds of things, sleep, I mean, all kinds of, I don't think I need to tell you. So learning to kind of just be present to life and to distinguish between our thoughts and our perceptions and our responses to life and life itself is kind of a foundation of our practice. So people in this intensive are learning all about mindfulness, formal mindfulness of sitting and walking, the mindfulness as they go about their day and daily activities, and very importantly, learning about how to be mindful of emotions and thoughts. So we have some self-awareness of what's going on within our mind. So this is the basis. And then the second part, which begins in the winter-spring, has to do with now that one has mindfulness, to begin to kind of look at, make sure that we are emotionally stable. And if there are still parts of ourselves that are still reacting from earlier types of emotional issues, you know what I'm talking about, that these things are healed. So we have an emotional stability so that we can really enter life and really deepen our own practice, our own spiritual practice, without always being short-circuited by our emotional reactivity that has often has been with us for a long time. So that's kind of the first path. Now the second intensive is called Deconstructing the Myth of Self. I kind of have a warm feeling for that one. Because it was actually maybe 10, 12 years ago that we, when we just began to do these intensive, that this is one of the first ones. And really, I think it was the first 6 months intensive that we did in this community. And see, most people in our culture, I think just that title, Deconstructing the Myth of Self, we go, what is he talking about, right? Because we believe that the self is a real thing. Most of us, we believe we're a solid, permanent self, and everyone else is a solid, permanent self. And our whole, really, life, emotional life, relationship life is based on that. So taking self and calling it a myth is what? Yeah, well, it's a story, isn't it, that tries to explain something. You know, so most religions or, you know, peoples, they have a creation myth, right? I mean, like, you know, how did we get here? So pretty much every religion has some sort of story, whether it's, you know, God created the earth in 7 days or some other gods did it or a Big Bang, you know, that's a scientific myth. You know, they're just stories because nobody really knows, do they? So we make up these stories. And then there are all kinds of myths that people live by. National superiority is a myth. Gender superiority, racial. You know, there are lots of myths of all types that people make up, right? That they somehow think are real, right? You know, we have a myth, and the Buddha discovered it was a myth 2,600 years ago, that our self, our identity, is some kind of solid, permanent thing, right? As if somehow inside us there is this thing called, my name is Fred, by the way, that there is a Fred, and he kind of runs the show, and everything that happens in his life is happening to him. So he's always, you know, making up stories about what's going on in life. And all the stories he makes up are based on what? The belief that I exist, and as opposed to everybody else. So I'm always advancing my own needs and wants, and I'm always trying to take care of myself, and I'm always overly concerned about my own well-being, my own pleasure, how people are treating me, how I want people to treat me, how I want to, you know, how I can be comfortable, how I can get more pleasure. You know, it's like this constant, endless, daily, nonstop obsession with what? With me. Right? Everybody know what I'm talking about? So the Buddha called this self a myth. That really, if you look into it, it really doesn't exist in the way we think. So this intensive, it's a long 6 months intensive, is really a wonderful intensive for people to really unpack that, so to speak, beginning really at the most obvious psychological level and then taking it deeper, deeper, and deeper, till one comes to the conclusion by oneself that it is a myth. But that's, for those of you who are new to Buddhism or Buddhist psychology, that may sound a little strange, but it's interesting. As opposed to Western psychology, which is based on self, Buddhist psychology is based on non-self. It comes at life very differently and obviously comes up with very different conclusions. And then the third intensive, and that's been going on since last year, is on this text called The Way of the Bodhisattva. And this is sort of the bodhisattva, we might say, in Buddhism, is the ideal. A bodhisattva is an awakened human being, somebody who is awakened to their full potential for wholesomeness, for goodness, that has eliminated all the unwholesome, right? And so has awakened to the true reality of who and what we are, but also a bodhisattva is somebody who is living for others. It's the motivation and aspiration of a bodhisattva is altruistic. And it comes from what I was just talking about, of the, you know, seeing through the myth of self. One no longer lives in an egocentric way, right? I mean, egocentric means I'm centered on myself. And most people in life lead an egocentric life. A bodhisattva leads an other-centric life, understands that we're all one family, understand that we all have the same needs. We all want to be happy. No one wants to suffer. And so understanding that in a deep way, the bodhisattva no longer, lives with a sense of territoriality, right? Most of us live with a sense of, we're like a country, right? We're always kind of defending ourselves, right? And then we're also always trying to advance ourselves. And then we also like to take over other things. We like to take over other people, So we very much function like, like our own little nation state, right? And some are more aggressive than others. Some are more, like in the world. Not all nations are the same, but basically, we lead an egocentric life. We are really, if we were honest, we would say we're really primarily concerned with our own happiness and ending our own suffering. A bodhisattva is an individual, not as if they're not concerned with that, but they kind of throw it in the pot of humanity, right? They want all beings to be happy. They want all beings to be free of suffering. Right? So we would say they are altruistic in their life, okay? So this text, which is was written, it's actually in verse, so it's really a marvelous text. It's the way of the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva is this enlightened being. It's sort of how to get there. So all the practices and teachings that a bodhisattva needs to awaken and to live that life is elucidated in this wonderful text. So before I, and again, we've been teaching from it, since long time. At least I think what we began last, when did we begin? Began the first of the year. So we're up to chapter 7. But before I begin, any questions about the three intensives and what was just shared? Anything not clear? Yes. The question is, how do the intensives work? A month before they begin, word goes out. We send out to all members a description, and the commitments of each of the intensives. Okay, and people then sign up. Okay, and each of the intensives, they're different, but they all have certain commitments, such as some have practice for 30 minutes a day, some 60 minutes a day. So, and there are readings, so there's a commitment to do the readings. It's sort of like college, or something. you commit to come to class, you commit to do the readings, you commit to showing up. But there are also talks, and these talks are we do that through what's called Zoom. It's kind of a video online through the computer. So there are talks for everybody, like every 4 weeks, that kind of talk about, you know, what we're going to be practicing in some of the intensive. There are assignments, like in all of them, some more in depth than others. You know, this week we're practicing these meditations. This week we're reading. There's also calls with mentors. So in smaller groups, the first one is a broader talk for everyone in that intensive, but also people are in smaller groups where they're meeting with a mentor to kind of every other week to more in depth going into how their practice is going. And so it's sort of, there are probably a few other things that I left out, but does that give you a sense of kind of how they function? Yeah. So again, we have people in intensives who don't live, you know, in Tampa Bay, because they're done through video conference. So people all around are doing that. Any other questions? Yes.
Are the intensives designed for newbies, or?
Well, as I just shared, the questions are, they're streaming this. So the question involved for newbies. So again, in our community, we have a couple of things. One is, there's a self-declaration. Obviously, the newer people go into the mindful living path, because that's kind of the beginning path. Because again, if one doesn't really have the ability to be present, right, and some grounding and some emotional stability, many people skip over that path and they jump right into their spiritual path and then their meditation. And then they wonder why it's not working, you see? You wonder why it's not working. And oftentimes it's not working because we don't have the requisites. You know, it's sort of like, again, coming back to our thing about, you know, college. If you go to college or high school, you know, you begin with the basic courses and then you move to more advanced courses. But you have to have taken the prerequisite first. Well, also, in the spiritual path, it really works the same way. You know, if we don't have some ability, some stability of mind, some ability to concentrate, you know, how are we going to ever master the more deeper meditations, right? Right, if our mind's still all over the place, if we're still struggling with our reactivity, right? If every time we sit down on the cushion, you know, we still have a lot of drama, you know, that's still going on in our life. And when we sit down to meditate, you know, the dramas of the past week or the past life and the future worries, you see what I'm saying? So it's often people find it difficult and they get frustrated in their, you know, in their spiritual unfolding, their meditative unfolding, because we haven't attended, you know, to the foundations, the basic. We don't have a good solid ground to develop ourselves. So in that sense, the path is developmental. You know, the problem these days is, as Americans, is, see, we can start anywhere, right? I mean, we can go on Amazon and we can buy any book, at any level we want, right? And oftentimes there are retreat centers and things, and you can just look around and you can, you know, if you have the money and the time, you know, you can go to anything, right? Deep, deep teachings. You know, we like, who wants to deal with the basics, you know? I'm looking for the deep stuff. You know, so people go to these kinds of retreats and they read these kinds of books and they hear these kinds of teachings, but they can't really apply them because they don't have the foundation. So to me, it's much better to get the foundation, the solidity, right, of the practice. And then you have, and then it all goes easy or easier than if we don't have the quote, kind of prerequisites. Does that explain things? Good. Any other questions before we... Okay. So this chapter, it's all wonderful, is called Diligence. And a number of weeks ago at a day of mindfulness, I was giving the Dharma talk. So I used the first just three verses that took up most of the Dharma talk. So I will not, I will just read them to you, but I won't comment on them. Or maybe I will briefly, let's see what happens. But if you're interested, they are. So the ones, they haven't been posted yet. Okay, but they'll be posted next week. And this one probably will some point, hopefully. You're a hopeful person. Good, I like that. So, diligence. And again, a more elaborated commentary will be, hopefully, on next week. And so Shantideva, the man who wrote this book in the 8th century, Indian, wrote, begins, "Thus with patience I will strive with diligence, for in such diligence enlightenment is found. If no wind blows, then nothing stirs, and neither is there merit without diligence." Diligence means joy in virtuous ways. Its contraries have been defined as laziness, an inclination for unwholesomeness, defeatism, and self-contempt, a taste for idle pleasure, and a craving for repose and sleep. No qualms about the sorrows of samsara. Laziness indeed is born from these. So, you know, in these early chapter, or in these early verses, again, this is again where if we don't have the basics, it's very hard for us to develop. So he says clearly, you know, there is these two things. There's diligence, a certain kind of energy, and then there's laziness, which he then defines what he's calling lazy. And if one has diligence, then enlightenment can be found. But if one doesn't have it and has these other qualities, enlightenment will never be found. And I commented it more deeply several weeks ago, but I think the important thing to understand is we need in our life, not just in our meditation practice, but in our life, you know, what is the energy, you know, that is kind of informing our life? Because that type of energy that's informing our life will have a lot to do with how we respond to all the situations of our life. Whether we're with ourself, whether we're with others, whether we're at work, wherever we are, what is the energy, the juice that is moving us? And he calls that energy, that thing that makes us diligent, that enthusiasm, is joy in virtuous ways. Okay? Which I think is very important. Because I think if we look at our life, we will see that we do have a certain kind of energy that we're living our life by, right? Right. For many people, you know, a big energy is what? Getting ahead in the world, right? That's what fuels us. Making more money, you know, that's what energizes us. Having fun. You know, having pleasure. You know what I'm saying? If we really look at it, we see, oh yeah, I mean, my life does have a certain kind of energy. You see, that's what energizes me. That's what makes me enthusiastic, right? Many people are, their enthusiasm comes from thinking about what they're going to do on the weekend. They kind of endure their week, you know. But their enthusiasm goes, but this weekend, good things are going to happen. Tonight, good things are going to happen. So we kind of, you know, rouse our energy. Do you see what I'm saying? And so we want to look at this. And he defines this energy of this kind of way of living is, you know, joy in virtuous things. It could very mean, another way to look at it is joy in wholesomeness. And when I say wholesomeness, it doesn't mean, being a goody two-shoes. It means that, in my relations with others, in the type of thoughts I have, in the type of emotions that I cultivate those that are wholesome, those that are good. Good for me, good for others, the way I take care of my body, the way I eat. You see, it's a diligence for wholesomeness, for goodness. Does that make sense? And once you get it, then it permeates your whole life and it creates enthusiasm. Right? Another, in Buddhism, it's often called joyful effort. Right? This path doesn't have to be a grind. Many Americans, we're used to kind of pushing through, That's our way of working. It's tough, it's rough, it's hard, but I'm going to push through and achieve my goal. It's a kind of, we often work in a joyless way in our culture. So in this practice, it's to be joyful that I found the path, that I know how to practice goodness. Okay, but anyhow, you can listen to the talk. So that's the first. So I'm going to skip ahead. I mean, this is many, many verses, and we can't, you're welcome to purchase the book and read it if you like. So I'm now skipping to 14. So he says, so take advantage of this human boat. Free yourself from sorrow's mighty stream. This vessel will be later hard to find. The time that you have now, you fool, is not for sleep. So he's you can see he's not a gentle soul, Shantideva. Centuries later, he's kind of talking to us. So take advantage of this human boat. This is interesting. He's talking about the human boat, meaning our bodies. You see, it's a boat. What's it a boat for? It's a boat for our minds. Right? Our minds have taken up residence in our bodies. But, our thoughts, our beliefs, our feelings, our emotions, our thoughts, are all of the mind, but, they're connected in this life to our bodies. So it's interesting. So take advantage of this human boat. See, many of us think the purpose of life is to always take care of the boat, right? How does the boat look? How does the boat dress? How can I give the boat comfort and pleasure? And So we're focused on the boat. But he's saying it's a boat. Boats are means to get us somewhere. It's a form of transportation, we might say, right? I mean, I guess, this was the 8th century. So take advantage of this human automobile, right? Or car, or plane. It's a means to get us somewhere. We don't stay on the plane, do we? When we arrive at our destination, we disembark. Right? Our car drives us from here to there. When we get to where we want to go, we get out of the car. Our purpose in life is not to take care of the car. Like obviously, when we're teenagers, we do spend a lot of time focusing on the car. But then we grow up, right? Take advantage. We are very fortunate to have this human life, this human mind, this human capacity for self-awareness and self-reflection and for transformation and healing. Take advantage of it. And he says, free yourself from sorrow's mighty stream. Free yourself from suffering, unhappiness, dissatisfactoriness, unsatisfactoriness, stress, whatever you want to call it. Use this life for purpose, for meaning, that will benefit you. Most of what we do only gives us short-term benefits. This vessel will be later hard to find. The time you have now, you fool, is not for sleep. I mean, sleep is, I mean, We know that for our health and well-being, it's good to get a decent night's sleep. So he means kind of like we're like sleepwalkers, right? It's that it's a kind of sleep of being unaware, right? And there are people who walk in their sleep, right? See, my daughter, when she was young, she used to, you know, be sitting there in the living room, and all of a sudden, she'd kind of be walking through. She was sleepwalking, right? I just go up and get her and kind of walk her back. But she really, I mean, she was walking, but she didn't know where she was, right? She was sleepwalking. She's walking, appears to be conscious, but she's really asleep. That's what he's talking about. We are like that. You know, we are going through our day, we are going through our activities, we're going through our life, but we're kind of asleep. We don't really know what's going on. You see, we're lost in our little, we're lost in our dreams. We're not awake. Okay. The time you have now, you fool, is not for sleep. You turn your back upon the sacred doctrine, supreme joy and boundless source of bliss. Why delight in mere excitement, in distractions that will cause you misery? So again, he's strong, Shantideva. There's nothing fuzzy-wuzzy about him, is he? He calls a spade, so to speak. You turn your back on the sacred doctrine. Sacred doctrine is, again, this path of awakening, this path of freedom, this path of liberation, this path that gives us every, you know, he says, that will bring us joy, that will bring us great happiness and bliss and sense of well-being. It's all here. It's all available to us. And yet we turn our back. Because what are we spending our time on? Why delight in mere excitement, in distractions? And again, I don't want to get in my soapbox, but again, I think never in human history, and again, I'm not going to defend this statement, but I don't think ever in the history of human beings has the capacity to be distracted and to keep one's senses and one's mind continually excited than right now, right? I mean, especially in these last 10, 20 years with the internet and the phones and the, you know, it is possible just to keep ourselves constantly aroused, constantly distracted, constantly kind of having these momentary excitements, right? But really nothing's going on, right? It's funny, it's interesting now when I fly on planes, and many people, you know, they have their own little phones or their own little, you know, and when I like go to the bathroom and I come back, you know what most people are doing, or a lot of people are doing? They're playing games, right? You know, they're just playing games, which is kind of keeping themselves, and they're probably trying to do something, aren't they? They're probably trying to win, right? Or get some points, or, you know, they're games, right? Isn't that they're you know, I mean, so they're, but it's really not life. It gives us the illusion, you know, that we're gaining something, but it's exciting, right? And it's distracting us. But what is it distracting us from? Perhaps a more meaningful way to live, way to be. And again, we have to be very aware that in our culture, the forces that create excitement and endless distractions is powerful. Right? And they have a means of reaching into our minds and our lives anywhere we go. Right? You know, everybody know what I'm talking about. I mean, we can be hooked in from the moment we get up to the moment we go to sleep. And even though life may be going on around us, you know, people are attending to the virtual world. So we have to understand that Shantideva wrote this in the 8th century in India. You know, he didn't know you didn't know what mere excitement and distractions you know really means. But we do, right? And we have to be very alert that it is so easy, because these people, you know, very creative minds are involved in endlessly creating ways to entertain and distract us, right? They're not just happening by themselves, are they? There are forces behind that that are doing it. I'm not saying they're like evil forces, right? But they're forces, right? It's the way they earn their living. And, you know, that probably will not stop. But we, the consumer, we can stop. That's our power. You know, they're not going to stop, but we can stop. And one of the ways he says is to kind of have enthusiasm for real life. To have enthusiasm for real meaningful life. Right? Rather than an enthusiasm for what? For entertainment and distractions. Right? I mean, like, it seems like more and more these days people can't wait to get away from life and get into their what? Their virtual life. Kind of that's where it's happening for many people. And I think there's a price, and we should look into that. Turn your back upon the sacred doctrine, supreme joy and boundless source of bliss. Why delight in mere excitement in distractions that will cause you misery? Now again, misery is a strong word. You might go, no, I enjoy myself. You see? Right? I mean, what's he talking about? These entertainments, these attractions. I'm not miserable. So what's the misery he talks about? Well, it's like the misery of an addict, you know? When they're using, when they're drinking, when they're using, they're not miserable, are they? They think what? Happiness. Right? But you know that the going up, you know, if you study the science of addiction, you realize the addict in their use is creating misery for themselves and obviously others. But they're not aware of it. So we often don't realize that by our seeming addiction to these endless pleasures and entertainments and distractions, we are causing misery for ourselves, because they will slowly begin to occupy more and more space in our minds. And what? And when we don't have them, we will go what? Crazy. Well, you're pretty far advanced to go crazy. But you'd find what? It's like being a teenager. It's like, you know, boring. See, there's nothing going on. It's boring. It's dull. I need some stimulation. My mind needs stimulation. So if we're not careful, even people who kind of know what they're doing, right? And there may be many people like that in this room who kind of understand that. And yet, if you look at your life, you may find, yeah, I am more and more addicted to these devices. And many addicts are like that, or alcoholics. You know, they think they know better. And I won't. Other people get addicted or become alcoholic. Not me. But, you know, these are addictive substances. And I think these days we have addictive medias. Okay, 16. Do not be downcast, but marshal all your powers, make an effort, be the master of yourself. So this is the practice on diligence, on energizing, right? You know, for us to go, oh yeah, it's not easy to do this, to change, to learn how to be mindful, to learn how to quiet my mind, to change, to heal, to develop wholesome mind. I don't know. Not easy for someone like me, you see. And he says, you know, don't be like that. Marshal your forces. Be master of yourself. Many of us do not feel we are in the driver's seat of our life, do we? We feel we are the victims of life and the victims of our mind. We don't even know our minds, and we feel like, my mind is out of control, right? Or my mind is so many unwholesome things going on in it. I'll never change. You know, I just got to kind of impose some kind of order that at least I can function in life. But whew, this mind, I got to keep it well hidden. Can't change it. See, that's what he's saying. Don't be like that. And actually, in the next verse, he says, oh, he must have known we were going to be talking about this today. He said, oh, but how could I become enlightened? And that's in quotations. Oh, but how could I become enlightened? And then in the verse goes on, Shantideva is saying, don't excuse yourself with such despondency. The Buddha who declares the truth has truly spoken and proclaimed that if they bring forth the strength of perseverance, even bees and flies and gnats and grubs will gain supreme enlightenment so hard to find. Now, I don't know what the reference is for the bees and flies and gnats and grubs, but the point he's making is, and this goes back to, you know, the fundamental experience that Siddhartha had, who became known as the Buddha, had over 2,600 years ago in his enlightenment, when he experienced that no matter what's going on in our mind, no matter what's gone on in our life, essentially, we are Buddhas. We, all of us, have this awakened capacity. Not out there, but in our minds. Again, we could say it means, you know, that no matter how dirty the water is, no matter how polluted the water is, no matter how murky the water is, if you know about filtration or reverse, you know what I mean? You know, oh, essentially, water is pure. We just need to get what? The impurities out. But the water itself is pure. We don't have to get rid of the water. We just have to put the water through a process of filtration and purification, and it will be drinkable water. So this is the teachings, the fundamental teachings of Buddha, and something that everybody who practices path has to believe. That fundamentally, no matter how, when you look into your mind, it seems like a mess, that's just the impurities that have come in. And we might say practice is the process of filtration. Okay? And that's all we need to do. So to excuse yourself with such despondency, but how somebody neurotic as me or screwed up as me or somebody with my past or blah, blah, blah. Now don't be insulted by those of you who take your stuff very seriously. But I'm going to call it blah, blah, blah. All of us have this capacity to purify ourselves. Doesn't mean that, you know, we don't have to go through a process of healing, right? I mean, healing is that one of the processes that we go. We heal our wounds. We calm our minds. We quiet our minds. We learn how to be present. And then we eventually learn how to concentrate and look more deeply into our minds. It is a process that has been taught since the Buddha and continues to be practiced and taught for over 2,600 years by millions and millions and millions of people throughout the world. Right? So for each of us to be despondent, oh, I can't do this, or this is not for me, is really to kind of not get this fundamental, right? Fact that is the ground of Buddhist practice. And if by and if by birth and lineage of humankind, so this is following that even bees and flies and gnats and grubs can attain enlightenment. He says, and if by birth and lineage of humankind I'm able to distinguish good from ill and do not leave aside the bodhisattva deeds, why should I not attain Buddhahood? This is very powerful. I hope some of you get it. So, we're not bees and flies. We're not grubs and worms and gnats. We are, by lineage and birth, a human being. Okay? We have a mind. We have self-awareness. We have this ability to be aware of ourself and to distinguish wholesome from unwholesome. Right? I don't know if gnats and flies and bees and squirrels and rabbits have that ability. But we do. Right? We have the ability of discerning as we look at our behavior, as we look at our thoughts, as we look at our patterns of speech, to discern once we learn some criteria. Many people don't have any criteria, but once you learn some criteria, to know the difference between wholesome and unwholesome. That which produces good and that which produces the opposite. Right? This is our gift, he's saying. Right? We can tell. We might not have known it growing up, but now the information is available to know the difference between wholesome food and junk food. Right? Is that clear? I mean, it's right. I mean, they have to put it on the labels. Right? See, when I was growing up, people didn't think that tobacco, caused cancer. Right? Now it's on the label. You know what I'm saying? It says right there, this product causes cancer. So distinguishing wholesome from unwholesome, that which is healthy for one and that is not, is easy these days. Right? You go to the store, you look in the ingredients. It'll tell you whether it's wholesome or not wholesome. Right. And so again, so we have a lot of things in our society where we have begun to designate very clearly what's good for us and what's not. What's good for our children, what's not good for our children. Right? So we have this ability. And if you're following a spiritual path or you have some kind of self-awareness, you can observe. You know what thoughts are good for you. What kind of mind states to ruminate about that are good for you. They produce goodness, happiness, peace of mind, calmness, open-heartedness. And you know which mind states, if you cultivate and ruminate and obsess about, will only cause misery for yourself or unhappiness, positive or negative. I mean, everybody clear? So, if we have some kind of self-awareness, we can see that. We have that. That's a wonderful capacity. He says, since I'm a human being, I can distinguish wholesome from unwholesome. And do not leave aside the bodhisattva deeds, which means, the bodhisattva undertakes deeds, which means, good action. In my relations with myself, my body, with other people, right, with society, I try to put goodness into it. Wholesomeness, protect human beings, protect the planet. Treat every human being with respect. See? Care for the less fortunate. Right? So, we do those kinds of actions, those kinds of deeds in our life. At the same time, we're cultivating, this path that awakens our mind. And he says, and if you do all that, why should I not attain the state of Buddhahood? Buddhahood means, in Buddhism, Buddha is like a fully enlightened being. That's all it means. Okay? Siddhartha, when he was, running around in the palace and carrying on, with all his concubines, he was not called the Buddha. Okay? It was only when he went through his own process of self-purification, awakening, that he was called the Buddha, and Buddha just means an awakened one. And in our tradition, anybody, any human being who awakens is a Buddha. So Anybody can aspire to be a Buddha. Everybody in this room can aspire to be a Buddha. And it will happen. Right? Even there are a couple of children back there. They can aspire to be a Buddha. Probably is easier for them than it is for us. Less impurities. So, we have a few minutes. Any questions? Anybody want to challenge this teaching? Say no. Yes.
So, you're talking about the self earlier. And in this particular teaching, it's also talking about the self as in the sense of purifying and focusing on the self.
Mm-hmm.
So, what is the difference between the self that we see in the Western world versus the self that's being taught here?
Yeah, so self... Oh. Got to repeat the question. So the question is, hey, what's going on here? Earlier you were talking about deconstruction of the myth of self, as if self is kind of a negative thing, right, that we need to, right? And here, Shanti Deva seems to be talking about the self as kind of doing positive things and really the vehicle for our transformation. So they're both true. And that's a good point. See, Buddhism doesn't say, and again, we're getting into it. So I don't want to get too deep into it. Buddhism doesn't say there's not a self. What Buddhism says, that which appears to be a solid, permanent self is just made up of parts. Okay, so we might say, this is a flower, right? But to say that there's some kind of permanent, enduring thing here called the flower would be a total misperception, because this flower is what? It's just made up of parts, you see? And if I just kind of take it apart, yeah, somebody's attached to the way things should be. But I will stop for the faint at heart. But you see, the flower is just made up of parts. There's no such thing here called a flower. But we call this a flower, don't we? We call it. Like we call this Fred. But it's the same thing. If we took Fred apart, we would not find anything called Fred. We'd find parts, right? Right, we find this, we call this a body, but this is really, there's no such thing as a body in reality. There's skin, and in this skin, there are lots of parts. And even the skin is made up of parts, cells, and you know. So that's what it says, right? So we got to stop looking at ourselves as some kind of fixed, permanent thing to understand we are just made up of parts, right? We're made of, who are we? Well, we're thoughts, feelings, perception. Where do we get these thoughts, feelings, perceptions? We got them from our family. We got them from our parents. We got them from their grandparents. We got them from all our experiences running around the neighborhood and going to school. And that's who we are. We have been created by our world, our society. We're not a permanent thing. That is why, right, we can now become conscious and decide, this is how I want to be, you see. Because I'm not a fixed thing. See, if we were fixed, then like everything that I, and that's, and people think they are, that everything that, I grew up in this family and I have to be exactly the way that way for the rest of my life. I had these issues in my childhood because of this trauma, that, and I have to be that for the rest of my life. No. There's nothing fixed, right? When you know that, right, this self that's not a self can become very helpful to direct our life in the right direction. So that's a good point. I mean, it's a little deeper, but it's in Buddhism. Buddhism is very interesting because it's not an either or. It's a both and. So you have these things like, there is a self, but it's really a not, it's a non-self. But if you want to call it a self, knowing that it's a non-self, that's fine. Right? It's sort of like if you get into the Heart Sutra, which is one of the deep sutras in Buddhism. It says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form. And we go, what? But that's another Dharma talk. Think about it. I mean, I've sort of shared a lot this morning. Anything that's not clear, or what Shanti Davis says, or anybody want to stand up for, you know, anybody as screwed up and wounded and neurotic as I could never awaken. I could never be free. Somebody must. I mean, a lot of people think that. And that's the reason he wrote it. Well, just let me ask you something else that I'm very happy to call. Just to make, is there anybody who wants to, and then I'll come back. Yes. Yeah, yeah, good.
In my observations, watching that my husband and I try and stay disconnected from devices as best we can. So we did not know that there was, shall I say, acts of violence in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So I watched myself go into that, the word, and then come back out and observe. And it was kind of like, you know, a hurricane was in Houston. Oh, I feel that feeling for those poor people. And then when it was here, it was myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the question is what? Just
so
go to the pith.
Dan and I are headed out in the dark in our walk, and I'm just watching that. You know, detaching from, I sent a message to this friend, she didn't get back to me, I'm worried that she lives right there. Yeah. And then myself was so I wonder if you could ask for that.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, again, so the question is, really, the question is, well, don't you need a little bit of self? Don't you need a little bit of involvement in information just to function with a common sense way in this life? And I'd say yes. Okay? So I'm not saying, burn all your devices. You know, I'm not a complete Luddite. You know, I'm not saying burn all your devices and, you know, totally disengage, because again, in our world today, this is the way we're sharing information. So to use it for a sharing of information, as you said, can be beneficial just to keep us aware. But you know, to what extreme and how many times you need to get the information and read about the information is really beneficial, and how much of it is just watering fear and other kinds of things. So. Yeah. Obviously, when the hurricane is coming directly to Tampa, we will respond a little differently than when the hurricane's coming directly to Houston. Right? Because there is a me that is a functioning thing, right? That has to kind of, we can't go, well, I'm a non-self, so in this body is just a boat, so I don't need to take too good care of it. I mean, I don't need to dress it today or what, right? No, we need to, take care of the boat. We need to take care of our lives. We need to take care of, right, life, but not the extremity of it, not the attachment to it. Yeah, obviously, when the hurricane's coming here, there are actions that we need to take or not take, depending on situation, our assessment, and all that. Is that? So it's, I mean, there is a common sense taking care of business without the extremity of egocentricity and selfishness and fears and, yeah. So if you know there's something going on in your neighborhood, you don't have to be in fear to make an assessment of the situation and act sanely with common sense. You see, but we are addicted to afflictive emotions. We think we got to be afraid before we act. But actually fear, as anybody who studied fear knows, fear is often a maladaptive response to a situation that just needs a response that is somewhat intelligent and common sense and, you know. So yeah, I mean, if there's danger, you may not want to go out for a walk in the dark. You know? But that's, you don't have to be afraid, you see, to make that assessment. That's a tool of our mind that has a way of assessing situations. Right? So, yeah. So, you know, form is emptiness, emptiness form, self, non-self. Whatever you do, don't give up your common sense. Okay? I mean, there is a just common sense about how to live life, and we need to relate to that. Is it a short one? Okay.
Devices.
Uh-huh.
Books, airplanes.
Uh-huh.
We used to use books as a distraction on a plane. Sometimes people would use it to not interact with others. Some would actually use it because they want to read a book.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays we have Kindles, iPhones. In my case, I enjoy reading.
Mm-hmm.
So I do use it as an advice for reading. What I heard you saying is that there is a place and time for the devices.
Yeah.
They can be books. A book is a device.
Yeah.
It just does not need to be something that you're indulged 24 hours a day, reading that same book until you finish.
Yeah, so that's, let me just, because we're running out of time. Yeah, so the question is, you know, are we, you know, am I talking abstinence? Or am I talking, you know, common sense use of? Yeah, and I would say the latter. I mean, we are lay people, right? That's good, but that's often our problem. I mean, if we lived in a cave, or we lived in the mountains, or we lived in a monastery, we wouldn't have to be having this discussion, even though it seems like monks and nuns are using these things these days, right? So we are in the world. So in the senses, we wanna be able to use the good things in the world without becoming addicted. You know, how do you know you're addicted? How do you know whether you're a social drinker or you're an alcoholic? How do you know it? What? Well, one thing is people will tell you it, right? But how would you know for yourself, kind of from the inside? You would know what? And a social drinker can take it or leave it, right? But if you need it for whatever purpose, for social purposes, for stress purposes, to help you sleep, you know there's something else going on. You're using it for something that it's not meant for, okay? So the same way, you know, to enjoy reading a novel or something, or reading something that's beneficial or meaningful, fine. But if you find, you know, you have to, you see, you have to watch Netflix every night, you see? You know what I'm saying? You know, it's gone beyond freedom. The spiritual path should give us freedom. Freedom means choice, options. It's no big deal. I can say yes, I can say no. Right? If it's obsessive, if it's a must-have, then we know what? We are not free. We are the slave of. Is that clear? And that there's a difference. And you know, I can't tell you that difference, but you know that difference. Each of us know that difference. Right? Where it is that it's become, you know, I just cannot. I mean, this behavior is compulsive these days. right? I mean, people cannot, right? You know, walk down the street, be anywhere without doing that, checking it. If you find you're doing that, you know you're addicted. You know, I mean, unless you're expecting, you know, some earth-shaking message from someone, there may be a reason to instantly check. But if not, what are you checking? What? The latest picture on Instagram? I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, like, what's the hurry? What's the urgency? Well, the urgency is not in that. The urgency is in our mind. That's become addicted. Is that clear? And again, because it's become so quickly socially acceptable, it seems normal. Is that, do you know what I mean? It seems normal, and I understand that. But, you know, we have to kind of step back and go, I didn't come out of the womb checking my email. You know what I mean? I mean, like, it, first couple of years of life, it wasn't, you know, I mean, so, you know, this is something that I've developed, right? It's not intrinsic to being a human being. Younger people may not realize that, but it's really not. Good, thank you. We'll stop here.